Good day, Dave.
Good day, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing all right, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. I'm excited. We have a guest here today, Justin Quinn. He's the owner of Focused on Machining. How are you doing today, Justin?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited to be here. Love listening to the podcast, so very excited to be a part of it.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just beside myself to have Justin here. We've talked about getting you up here, man, and we just love working with you, so we're so happy that you joined us this morning.
Likewise. Look forward to doing this more in the future.
Awesome. Also, what are you doing next week?
Right?
Little shout out to Garrett and Nick and your team back there in Luviers, Colorado.
That's right. They're keeping things going while I'm here, hopefully, anyways.
Not hopefully, man. You got a process. Come on.
That's right. They're doing good.
So Justin from Focused on Machining, and we're just going to talk about where it all began.
Yeah, so I'm Colorado native, grew up here, joined the Air Force right out of high school, was an aircraft mechanic, stationed up in Seattle area. So I spent 6 years of my life either working on airplanes or flying around the world, also working on airplanes. But
Very cool.
did that for 6 years, learned a lot, traveled the world. I've been to like 36 different countries. All seven continents, including Antarctica, so a lot of really good
Is it really
experiences.
cold up there? Is that true? Is it really cold up
It
there?
is a little chilly, yeah. It was like I landed on the ice 3 times, and I think the warmest it was like negative 25-ish.
Holy cow.
So they hook you up with some gear though. They have the big down jackets with kind of that fur hood, So it didn't feel cold because we were dressed appropriately.
Right on. Well, first off, thank you for your service. Much appreciated.
Absolutely.
Mike and I think the world of veterans, and obviously we think the world of you, so thank you for that. So there's going to be a little sidebar here because you, as an aircraft mechanic, at times you would fly in to a hot area and have to fix an airplane in a hot area, like right now, right?
Yeah,
So give us a story. Give us a story.
So one of the craziest stories I ever had was during that big earthquake that hit Pakistan. So I was actually deployed downrange in Qatar at the time, kind of supporting the Iraq mission. We had been tasked with doing humanitarian runs inside of Pakistan when that earthquake happened. So we were short on mechanics because we were all flying, taking care of that normal, duty while we were there.
Sure.
So they told me, here's what's going to happen. We're going to do four flights, four drops inside Pakistan. You're going to be on the first aircraft in. You're going to get off with your toolbox, your tools, service that aircraft, inspect it, get it back out, and then two more are going to come, service them, make sure they can get in and out, and then you'll be on the fourth one out. So I was like, okay, yeah, that'll work. So I get there, right? We get to Pakistan and get the aircraft serviced, get all the cargo offloaded, fueled up, inspected, get it back out, and then it's just me. It's pitch black,
Are you serious?
middle of Pakistan. There's people riding their bikes like across the runway. I mean,
Just you.
just
You're
me.
the only one there.
No, I'm the only one that speaks English that's there. I kind of had a little, there was a small building there. I just kind of hunkered down next to kind of a little crevice where the door opened, just sat there and just
You had a
hung
firearm?
out. I did. I had a firearm with me. It wasn't a hostile area per se, so there wasn't a lot of threat, but it definitely was a little unnerving,
I'm sure, I'm sure.
being there, and it's pitch black and just, man, I hope these other aircraft really are coming because if not, it's a long walk home. Yeah,
You swim well?
it went off without a hitch. Two other aircraft came in. We got them fueled up. We got them inspected. We got cargo off. And thankfully, that fourth airplane made it. And I hopped on and we went home. And they came in pretty quick succession. It was, I think it maybe only had an hour to 2 hours in between
Okay.
each one, but those were long
I'm
hours.
sure.
You
I'm
know,
sure.
it was a
Especially.
lot of questioning going on, and
Holy
because I
cow.
had been on flights where, we have a mission and we're headed to one spot, and in flight you get a call and it's like, okay, we're diverted, we're going here now, and so I just kept running that through my head like, don't get diverted. Please come. don't forget that I'm here, guys. Please.
You can go to a Starbucks and wait there.
Right.
Yeah. So you're saying you didn't have Wi-Fi?
No, there was no Wi-Fi. Yeah.
I got to take this kid's bike, and I got to pedal about 1,500 miles. I'll be back.
But it was so interesting because, you know, airfields in most areas, especially in the U.S., super secure areas, right? I mean,
sure,
nobody's getting within miles of that airfield. And here in Pakistan, there's literally people riding their bikes crossing the runway. It just was like, it was weird. The first thoughts that went through my head is like, what is this person doing? Like, you know, suspicious and what's going on? Yeah. And after a while, I kind of just, you kind of get into that realization that, how they run things.
Yeah, why don't they let people ride bicycles across runways now? You know, it's great pavement.
It is. It's nice and flat. It's long. You know, it's really good bike riding in space.
Get a mile or so each way. Just go back and forth. You got your workout.
That's right. That's right. So that was one of the craziest experiences I had. And then, of course, you know, going to places like Antarctica. I mean, just
real
opportunities that you just kind of don't come across unless you're in the military doing that kind of stuff. It was fun.
Outstanding.
So let's divert the conversation. So you're a business owner. Congratulations. Very happy for
Thank you.
When did that, like, that dream of being a business owner enter your mind?
So I've always had that kind of want and drive, if you will. I come from a family of small business owners. A couple of my uncles own their own business. Other family members have done their own thing as well. So I've always had that kind of in me, if you will.
Sure, sure.
Just never really acted on it, never really had an idea of what I wanted to do. So after the military, I got out, came back home, went to school. I got my bachelor's degree in finance, and I graduated in 2010. Not a great time to graduate with a finance degree. You know, there was a lot of people in finance looking for work at that time due to the recession. But I had an opportunity in banking. It was a new kind of startup bank, if you will. So I jumped at the opportunity. It was kind of an entrepreneurial jump, if you will. I got to work with the CEO who started the bank. I was his financial intern.
Really?
So I was doing a lot of financial reporting for the bank, helping with board packets, things like that. And then quickly, as people started to kind of realize my skill, I really got pretty good at building reports and mining data out of the banking system.
Sure.
So then other departments inside the bank started reaching out to me and asking me, hey, can you get me information on this? Or can you get me information on that? And I started building all these reports, started customizing them, started like automating the reporting to these department heads. And that led to an opportunity in underwriting. So I moved into underwriting, started underwriting loans, working in the credit department. I did that for a year and a half, almost 2 years. Before I got my first opportunity as a lender, as a junior lender. So I moved to a branch, took over a small portfolio. That's where I started working with customers, business owners.
Direct.
Directly, yeah. Started working on loans with them, working on deposits, just kind of managing that banking relationship with them. And I did that until my career ended in banking about three and a half years later.
On that front, you know, you said that you progressed to the point where you had a portfolio, right? And you had some companies that you were kind of responsible for the caring and feeding of those companies. One of the things we encounter a lot with the small, medium-sized business owner is they think that between their CPA and their banker, that if no news is good news, if my CPA doesn't say, hey, you're doing this wrong, then I must be doing it right. Or if your banker says, hey, you're doing this wrong, then I must be doing it right. What do you think about small and medium-sized businesses having put all their eggs in their CPA and banker basket?
I would say if you're not conversing with those two folks on a regular basis, monthly, in some sort of a consulting type role,
sure,
you're probably out of sight and out of mind. From a banker's perspective, you're really only dealing with that customer when you're working on a loan application with them. When you're addressing, you know, needs that they bring to you, they need a new operating account, something like that.
Sure, sure.
Outside of that, you're really not looking at that relationship. You're not looking at financials. You're not working on that small to medium sized business other than processing an application or something like that. So unless you're really bad off to where you're on the past dues, you know, there's this big middle area of businesses that just aren't being touched on a regular basis.
Yeah, so those small and medium-sized business owners think they have a partner, but in fact they don't have a partner.
Correct. Yeah, it's transactional. It's based on the request or the loan renewing, something like that.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that, you know, your background from banking to small business owner, because it gives you a tremendous head start, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I never targeted the banking industry as an interest for myself. It was more of that was the opportunity that presented itself to me at the time. But I learned a ton about business that I thought I had known being a finance business graduate.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about, you know, what business really was all about.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference between what a bank thinks, you know, is good business versus what is reality. And that's where a lot of the differences come from bankers and business owners is, you know, a bank really wants to lend money to people that don't need money, right? I mean, they want to get repaid and they want that 100% security.
It's all risk mitigation, all about risk.
Right. And if a business is that secure, they're not going to need a bank. They're going to be profitable enough. They're going to have cash flow. They're going to be their own bank. So really banks are working with those in between folks, you know, that are not so bad off that they're not bankable, but they're still, they have that need.
Now, banking is a tool that shops or businesses need, but I've always said, you know, if you really want loyalty in a bank, go get a dog, because they're only going to, when you really need them, if you're out of cash, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for them to support you, but you have to have a good relationship with the bank and your banker for sure.
Yeah. They're going to, you know, as much as they can do, they will be there to bat for you when it matters. But, you know, the numbers are going to determine the majority of that decision.
And the numbers right now, not necessarily what they're going to be in 3 months.
No,
numbers as you give them the doc.
It's more historical than it is right now, even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might weight the current period a little heavier than the past,
mm-hmm.
but they almost never are going to look forward and give you any credit for that. They're going to want to see that you have a budget and a plan just to see that you went through that motion. But they're never going to land on those projections. They're never going to say, oh, he's going to do this. Let's give him a bunch of money. It's all going to be based on historical financial information.
Will they lend based on a PO?
I have not experienced that.
Hmm.
Yeah, so Justin, I remember you telling me that for the small and medium-sized business owner, it's important for them to understand that when you need a loan, now is not the time to try to get your financials together. I mean, it's too late. If you got to be doing that 2-3 years prior to your actual need.
That's right, Mike. That's why we push the financial plan so hard, so you can be prepared and you know when in advance that way you're not in a pickle. Because once you're in a pickle, you're in the pickle, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But okay, so you went into banking. So talk me through still how the dream.
Yeah.
How the dream came to be and all that.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, you know, I always had that kind of business mindset. I wanted to own my own thing. I just didn't know what and how and where. But my experience in banking kind of really reinvigorated that in me. I worked with a lot of small business owners and some very successful, some kind of struggling, some in that area where I think a lot of small business owners are, where they just chase their own tail and it, you know, they might have a year where they do a little bit of profit and that's like a great thing, but they never get out of that and never really kind of ramp up and become very successful like they want to. So I saw that and I just had more and more confidence that I could do that. I could run and own a business and make it successful. So I you know, talked about it with my wife, of course, and we just went on this journey together where we set out to buy a company. And I didn't really have a specific thing I was targeting. I wanted it to be in a blue collar industry. I wanted to get back to that, right? I really missed the camaraderie I had in the military, the down to earth nature, the, you know, the people that get things done, that make things. I wanted to get back to that because that meant a lot to me, and I really missed it being in banking. In banking, I felt like I just shuffled papers, and you know, it wasn't. I didn't feel like I was providing a lot. So I wanted to get back to that industry. I was working with the RMTMA as a banker, you know, trying to business develop in that arena. So I was
Rocky Mountain Tooling Machining Association.
Correct. Yeah, okay. It's the local trade association for machine shops and manufacturers. So I had started building relationships in that industry a little bit, and I had reached out to an insurance rep actually that specifically sold insurance to machining, and told him kind of my story. We had lunch, told him what I wanted to do and what I was all about, and he kind of fell in love with the idea and me a little bit. You know, there's not a lot of young at that time, late 20, early 30 somethings that wanted to get into manufacturing. So he was really on my side, and he was connecting me with people in the industry, both business owners and other folks. So early on, he put me in touch with Rich Pohlmiller, who was the current owner at Focused on Machining. And Rich was not wanting to sell his business. He just had been in the industry a long time, really good guy, really down to earth, and you know,
baby boomer.
Yeah. He's in his, say, mid to late 50s right now, probably. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, he had started his own business focused on machining after working in manufacturing for 20 plus years, and he just met with me, just kind of heard my story, kind of just wanted to get to know me, and same thing, just really liked who I was, obviously my age, and just the one thing I heard a lot on this journey was, you must be crazy, you know, to go in and want to buy a manufacturing company or a machine shop, right?
Yeah, those people are crazy.
right. So he and I had lunch, and you know, we hit it off. We probably sat for two and a half hours.
Wow.
And we kind of, after that, we kind of went our ways. You know, I continued down the journey looking at shops that were for sale. I actually wrote three other offers on other shops after I talked with Rich and before I bought Focused on Machining. Those transactions just never really worked out. They never came to fruition. We could never agree on price. And that's one thing that I kind of realize now is a lot of manufacturing companies think their value is a lot higher than it probably is.
Sure.
You know, they look very heavily into the assets, into, oh man, I spent $200,000 on that machine, and I spent $100,000 on that machine, and there's $100,000 of tooling. But you don't realize that machine is now 15 years old, that machine's 10 years old, half your tooling is regrinds or, you know, something that's not really
That's not valuable. Even it. I mean, it's never the input of the business that you measure the worth. It's always the output. It's the EBITDA.
Correct.
That's why we're EBITDA growth systems, because everything is based on a multiple of your EBITDA and your net profit. So, I mean, that is where everything rides. So if you have $17 million in equipment and you generate about $100,000 a year in net profit, well, guess what? Your business is not going to be worth anywhere near $1 million.
Yeah, in that case, you really should just try to sell the equipment.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And right. I think that's a decision a lot of machine shops are facing, especially baby boomers, right? Is like, how do I garner value out of this thing I've been doing for 20, 30 years other than just liquidating and auctioning? Sure. And that's sure, where... Right. That's where working with, I think you guys will come in really handy. And that's what it's done for my shop is help me realize what that value is and how to drive that value
up
versus just having an auction one day.
So did Rich call you back or how that?
Yeah. So, he just called me up out of the blue and kind of asked how I was doing, what I was up to. And so again, we met for lunch, and he and I, you know, I told him that I'd been writing some offers and just hadn't got any traction, and he started asking me questions about valuation and how I was coming to my numbers. You know, and I kind of explained to him it was a multiple model, right? I was looking at 3 years of financials, 2-3 years of my financials, kind of trying to gauge what the cash flow of the company was, mm-hmm, and how much money I could put in versus how much I thought it would yield in the next 4 or 5 years. And that was kind of how I came up with a number of what would make sense to purchase this and make it an investment, right?
Sure.
How is this an investable business? And so he started, you know, asking me some of those questions, And he kind of threw it out there. He's like, well, what would you value my shop at? So I quickly asked him, you know, well, what have you done the past couple of years? What has your revenue been? What has your net income been? And I, on the back of a napkin, I kind of added back some depreciation numbers, interest, you know, some of the non-cash expenses. Mm-hmm. And I quickly got to an average, and then I kind of multiplied it by four. That was kind of my starting point. It was four and a half, somewhere in that range. And I threw out a number, and I said, oh, it'd be about X. And he said, he kind of sat and thought about it for a minute. And he like, yeah, that sounds about right. He's like, you should buy Focused on Machining. And I was just like, it was interesting because after that first conversation with him, I went home, I talked to my wife, and I was like, oh, this shop was, it was beautiful, right? I mean, he had the white floors, mm-hmm. machines were nice. It was just on the next level for some of the other shops I had been in. But the financials looked the same, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. So I told my wife, I said, you know what? If this shop wasn't 50 miles away, this would be perfect. Well, after going through the year that I had and writing offers and being turned down, that 50 miles seemed a lot smaller than it did initially. So it was kind of one of those things where everything just worked out. The next day, I was in Rich's office. We had hammered out an agreement. We shook hands. We were with attorneys that same day. And 28 days later, we had closed.
Wow.
Yeah. It was quicker than buying a house.
That's good.
It was interesting. So it just worked out. I gave notice at the bank. And the scary part was my first day at Focused on Machining was literally my first day at that shop.
Yeah.
I had met Rich at the shop one day, but we went straight to lunch. I didn't walk through. Didn't do anything. So my first day on the job was my first day there.
Wow.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Well, what was your greatest challenge there in that first 90 days?
Just understanding the operation as it was, sure, right? As Rich had designed it and built it. So that was, I just immersed myself in understanding the flow of work, the working with the customers, the buying, the getting the work to the shop floor. I really had no idea how the shop floor did what it did and then getting parts back out. So I spent the first 90 days doing that.
What day did you close? I mean, what day?
October 26, 2016.
16. Okay. So we engaged you about 3 years later.
Correct. Yeah. Rich had left on February 1st, 2017. Mm-hmm. So he was with me for all of November, December, January. So I had 3 months with Rich. It was. And it was interesting because as I took over, I had wanted him there 6 months, right? Like I wanted him there because I was like, oh my God, you're the person that knows this thing. I need you here. But by that 90 days, it was like, okay, I got this. I'm ready to run with my own, my own ideas. So, and then really what I spent doing that first 3 years before you guys was completely changing the operation processes, systems of the company. Rich had been ISO certified, but had let it lapse. Literally, I think the day I bought the company, his expired because he just didn't want to pursue it anymore. It was a lot of work. And mind you, at the time, you know, it was completely paper process. There was no computer system in place. There was nothing. So I could see how ISO is burdensome when you have no ERP system. You have nothing. It's all spreadsheets and Word documents. It's hard to run a quality system with that.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't fault him at all. Like that, I mean, I can't imagine doing that. That's unbelievable.
Doing it that way, it's very hard to
do. So that's
successful.
What I spent doing right away. You know, we, within the 3 month time period, I had an ERP system in place. I also had got our ISO recert. So in January, I had ISO come back out. We got I think I had to go through two meetings with them because our first one, we had some non-conformances that we had to correct. And mm-hmm. by March, I had re-ISO certified the shop.
Wow.
So we had ERP in place, ISO, and then we started seeing transition of individuals, right? I brought on a very experienced lady in the industry. She was kind of my office manager / sales, but we didn't have a big need for sales early on. We were at capacity, and I put that in quotes because we were completely busy at the shop, but we truly had more capacity.
Sure,
we were in that rat race. Yeah, inefficient. Mm-hmm. So she was more of an office manager, helping me do the ISO documentation, all that.
Right.
She I think she left us that summer just because she wasn't doing, she wasn't in her proper role.
Okay.
So she left that summer. So then I was really kind of flying solo starting in that summer. In between that period, I want to say late spring, I had brought on a general manager. He was a very experienced machinist. He had done other management type things in the industry. So he was kind of my go-to on the technical side. So he and I ran the company together for about a year, almost 2 years, mm-hmm. I guess. It was almost 2 years. And it was interesting. At about the year and a half mark, you could see he and my opinions diverging, right? He was a 25-year vet of the industry. There was a period in time where you could kind of see where some of the innovation and some of the things slowed, and it was more about just this is the way we do things and this is how we always done them kind of thing.
The paradigm shift.
Correct. And then so that's when he and I started shifting, right? I wanted to take it to the next level, and I wanted to drive to metrics and data. Mm-hmm. And I really had a comfort level at that point in time of the business where I knew enough technically to where I knew was, no, we can do better than that.
Sure.
You know, we don't need 4 hours to set up that machine. We can do better than that. It shouldn't run like that. I mean, we had some newer equipment. Yep. I knew we should be pushing the envelope of these machines. We should be, 20 minutes to profile and drill a hole on a part is not realistic. That should happen in 5, maybe less.
Where are you getting your data? Is it through RNTMA?
Yeah. A lot of it was going to these big events, touring other shops, talking with other shop owners.
Yeah.
I have always been one to where I kind of look up, right? I look up to someone, I find someone that is in a spot I want to be at, and I drive to that. Hirsch Precision was one of those companies, and Mike was a great mentor to me. I reached out to him a lot with some questions, and I visited his shop, and I saw the things he was doing with his equipment, and I was like, I know we can do more, and especially when I started doing the calculation backwards.
Sure.
When I started, here's what I think we should be making versus here's what we did make, and those two numbers were very far apart. That's when I quickly started realizing that the old ways of doing things are too much ingrained here still, and we need to start changing.
And I'll tell you, looking up to Mike Hirsch and have a conversation with Mike, what a great man, businessman. I mean, all the way around, just a phenomenal winner. So that was a good pick for a guy to talk to and get to know.
Yeah, he's I can't speak highly enough of him and what he did for me personally, and just the advice. And we still continue to drive, even though he's since sold his business, we still continue to drive towards that level of efficiency in that size of a shop, really.
Yep.
That's what we're striving for today. So then myself and that general manager started kind of getting farther and farther and farther apart until the relationship just broke. And it was actually interesting. I was on vacation. And we had some disagreements, and we kind of got into it via text while I was away from the shop. And we came back to work on that Monday, and we sat down, and we both just realized that this is the end of this relationship. It was very cordial. It was very, we shook hands, and we told each other how thankful we were for each other. And it was a very nice exit, but it was just time for us to grow into our own,
right?
And time for him to go somewhere else. And then that's when I promoted one of my young go-getters off the floor into production management, Garrett, who you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And we've just been on a rocket ship ever since. And it really was that catalyst that allowed me to invite the idea of working with someone like yourself with EBITDA Growth Systems. I finally had kind of seen some of those things let go and see the shop starting to grow. And I knew I wanted more, right? I wanted to go from, not doing $1 million a year to 5 to 10 million. But I also knew that I could probably figure that out on my own, but it was going to take 20 years to get to where I wanted to go. And I knew if I brought in some professionals to help me and coach me and guide me, we could get there a lot faster and probably what I've realized since a lot more profitable.
So this is part one of a two-part series. And so next 5 minutes, we're going to wrap this podcast up. But one thing I'd like to pick your brain about, When you got in the business, was it what you expected? What kind of stress did you go through? What stress did that cause at home? Because there's a lot of business owners that work more hours than Quakers got oats, right? They work all the time. And they go home and they don't have much to show for it, you know, besides look at the product I'm generating. And I have so much pride in what I'm shipping my customer. So talk to me a little bit about your experience around that.
I would say it was everything I expected and everything I didn't, which sounds weird, right? And everybody talks to me about what is it like owning your own business. What it's everything you can imagine and everything you can't. It's all the excitement. It's all the pride, the joy, but it's all the bad too. It's all the negative, the scariness, the threat. It's all of those peaks and valleys. And being a business owner, sometimes those peaks and valleys happen in the same day.
Sure, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you win a new job and you're like, you're on the top of the mountain. And then right away you scrap a part that took you 3 days to make the next hour. Sure. And you're just in the gutter. Like, how can I afford to redo all of this? So it's such a roller coaster of emotions. It's freeing, but it's also... It's also the opposite.
Very constraining.
Yes. I do make my own schedule, right? I can come and go as I please, but that has a consequence. If I come and go as I please too much, the business suffers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to do now. That's the stage I'm in now, is how do I develop my team to handle the day-to-day and allow me to plan strategically and grow the company from an owner's perspective, from a manager's perspective, and not be stuck in the day-to-day, not be the one guy that sends the quotes out, not be the one guy that purchases material. I'm trying to not be the guy that walks the shop floor and checks with every machinist and every person on where this job is at. I'm trying to develop that team to handle the day-to-day so I can focus on doing the big picture stuff and driving growth and profitability.
Being the president and CEO of your company, and we love that about you. The thing about being a small business owner, typically, you wake up every morning unemployed.
Yeah.
And so that's, the good news is it's your company. The bad news is it's your company.
Right, right.
But once you get your company to the point where it's professionally managed by people who work for you, and you can become the CEO, then you also work for that company.
Right.
So you don't wake up unemployed, you wake up employed by focused on machine.
Right. And that was one of the driving factors was to engage you guys was, you know, running the numbers, and we finally started having success. We turned two profitable years. Percentage wise they weren't huge, but we had more money than we did when we started the year, which was a good thing. But I just knew we could do better, you know. There are companies out there that are wildly successful. And I've always had the mindset that if they can do it, I can do it.
Sure.
If you can do it, I can do it. And so that's what prompted me to bring you guys on, engage with you, work with you on a regular basis, so we could be one of those highly successful companies. And we can grow. And really, this now after working with you guys for over a year, I mean, the sky's the limit. It's not a matter of, you know, what I want to do, but how big, how quickly do we want to do it? We have solid plans in place for every desire I have, and we're working towards them every single day.
So Mike, I'll just say it. It's, as a small business, it's wonderful to have Justin here to talk about the dream and to talk about where he wanted to go and where he was and that story, right? It's a wonderful story, and a lot of business owners have that story. Whether taking it over, whether they're purchasing a company. And it's something that we have a huge heart for, these men and women that are out there, you know, busting their butt and trying to make it happen. And just to wrap up part one, you know, our heart goes out to you guys. We want you to be very successful. We want you to step up. Justin has really climbed this mountain. He's still climbing. And we want to let you know that you can too. And we're going to go on to part two. You'll see, as it'll be in our next episode. But what do you think, Mike? Have anything to add?
No, I mean, again, I'm delighted to have Justin here to tell his story, because I think his story is unique to him, but it has, you know, some semblance to a lot of stories. But I think the key when we hear Justin's story is how mindful he was in each step. Like, I have a vision for myself, And it, you know, Rome wasn't created in a day, so I'm not going to get there in one day. But to just constantly be grinding, moving forward, you know, to achieve it, I love the story.
And the paradigm mindset, everyone. This is one of those things that it doesn't just have to be that way because it's always been that way. The one thing I love about Justin is if they can do it, I can do it. And doggone it, I'm going to figure it out. I'm not satisfied with where I am. It's not okay or good or just surviving isn't good enough. Let's thrive. If we're going to do this, let's make it worth it. Let's get together and figure it out and put a plan together and drive to success so we're all winning.
Right on, Dave.
Right on, Mike.